All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. All right, but now we go to Robert Polito. I'm not sure yet. He is an associate professor of political science at Seton Hall University, a former trial attorney, and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. He's the editor of Torture and State Violence in the United States, and has an article co-written with his wife, Laura Melendez Polito, or Polito, I don't know yet. Today it's rerunning from Foreign Policy in Focus at antiwar.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Robert?
Very well, thanks.
And how do you say your last name? I'm sorry.
Polito.
Polito, okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if the two T's meant that I had to shorten the I or exactly how that goes, but I'm sure you've run into that before.
Yes, yes.
Right. Okay, great. Psychologists and torture then and now. It's a tragedy and farce story, you say.
Yes.
And so which is the tragedy and which is the farce?
Well, I mean, the tragedy is that this happened in the first place, and Alfred McCoy, the historian from University of Wisconsin, has detailed the history from the Cold War when the CIA was sort of looking for researchers who would help them explore mind control. They thought that the Soviets were making advances in mind control, which helped them to brainwash prisoners, and the CIA was hoping that we could catch up. And unfortunately, there were psychologists who were willing to participate in various forms of experiments funded by the CIA, and ultimately much of this research found its way into counter-interrogation protocols that the United States was using. So that was what happened 60 years ago, and it was tragic that it happened in the first place, but what we were struck by is how this history is sort of coming back to us now in the post-9/11 world.
Mm. Well, yeah, it's interesting how even just right here in the first paragraph, you guys have it straight that they went with all their MKUltra mind control experiments, but they kind of all bled over pretty quickly, it looks like, into just plain old interrogation. And especially if you're a Latin American colonel and you're torturing a Latin American victim, this is the kind of stuff that you do to just your regular captives on a regular basis, I guess. Same for the Vietnamese?
Right. Well, the problem is that some of the research had to do with how is it that people would confess to things that were false. Albert Biederman studied some captives who had been interrogated by the Chinese military in the Korean War, and said that it was remarkable how people would confess to all sorts of outlandish things. So Biederman was interested in the process by which people end up saying anything that isn't true. But tragically, these methods were studied and then applied to at least theoretically get useful information. So it was sort of misguided from the start, and then things just went from bad to worse.
Mm. And yeah, if anybody wants their heart broken, please read A Question of Torture by Alfred McCoy. It'll certainly it's enlightening in all the worst ways, but there you go. So and now the farce, I mean, in this case, George Bush's torture regime, I guess, wasn't as cruel maybe as the one in Vietnam, but, you know, people freezing to death, being beaten to death at the salt pit outside of Kabul, that's no joke.
No, it isn't. I mean, and we frankly will never know all of the extremes to which some of the torture went, and of course there are things that were done in our interrogations, which I think as a matter of law constitute torture, like waterboarding. There are also things that were done when people were rendered, like Maher Arar, to another country that didn't observe at least the legal norms prohibiting torture. And so those descriptions of those tactics are also, as you said, heartbreaking and horrifying, almost impossible to read. So there were things that were done that were every bit as horrible physically in terms of mutilation and horrible pain as anything you could find anywhere else. And many times this was done by surrogates. In other words, people to whom we rendered subjects to be interrogated and then tortured.
Mm-hmm. And now, so it sure does seem strange that psychologists, who I guess, you know, aren't doctors, are they not bound to stay out of things like, you know, tying somebody up and beating them up? It seems like they're, you know, pseudo-doctors. You know, there's like a chiropractor still bound from doing harm, isn't he?
Yes, I mean, that's one of the points that we raise in the article, is that there are all kinds of ethical constraints on psychologists. One of them is to do no harm. Another is to respect confidentiality of patient information. Another is to consider a client's interests rather than other interests in utilizing psychological techniques. And unfortunately, many of these constraints were violated. Particularly, there's been a lot in the news. The New York Times has covered this, Vanity Fair, other journalists, about Mitchell and Jessen Associates. These mm-hmm. guys were two psychologists who really were not specialists in anything related to coercive interrogation or resistance protocols. I think one of them studied family therapy, but they saw an opportunity after 9/11 to get involved in advising the government on how to do effective interrogations. And now there have been allegations that that this involved ethical violations, and there have been proceedings to see whether they should lose their licenses. Unfortunately, to date, this hasn't happened. And one of the things that we pointed out is that psychologists lose their licenses for all sorts of things, including billing irregularities. And here is something far more severe. And to date, no one has suffered that consequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't want to be too vague and, you know, fudge it too far, but it seems like there's some responsibility there on the rest of them. What is their interest? They're trying to protect so bad that they would rather not clean their own house of torturers.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. I mean, the American Psychological Association is a professional association. It's similar to, for lawyers, the American Bar Association. So the ABA makes recommendations. The ABA often gets involved in vetting candidates for judicial office. But they ultimately can't enforce state licensing standards. That's up to the states. So, for example, if a lawyer is disbarred, that's usually a result of the state bar in which they're licensed imposing that disciplinary sanction. So what the APA has done is it's contacted some of the licensing boards in states, or at least one of them, and urged that should these allegations prove to be true, and, of course, the APA doesn't have the first-hand knowledge of the evidence, but should this evidence prove to be true, then anyone who engaged in such tactics should lose their license. So, I mean, in our view, this is an improvement.
But there is no investigation, though, to settle this question, right?
No, there hasn't been. And, in fact, Stephen Reisner from an anti-torture human rights group, who is also a psychologist, has actually filed suit to compel a licensing board to do an investigation, and so far that suit has not been successful. I mean, there's an appeal pending now. So no, and to the extent that licensing boards have investigated, we don't know because they haven't reported back to the public about it. I mean, if you look, for example, at the state of Texas board of licensing for psychologists, they will list members who have lost their license and the reasons why they lost their licenses, but you cannot tell what is ongoing. And that's fairly normal with a lot of different investigations, internal affairs for the police or disciplinary actions against lawyers.
Right. Okay, well, I got more questions. Here we are
okay.
At the break. Music's playing. We got to go. We'll be right back on the other side with Robert Polito. He writes for Foreign Policy in Focus, and we're rerunning a piece he has with his wife here at antiwar.com today. It was originally at Foreign Policy in Focus. Laura Melendez Polito and Robert Polito, psychologists and torture, then and now. We'll be right back. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Robert Polito. He and his wife have a piece at antiwar.com today. It was originally at Foreign Policy and Focus. That's FPIF.org. It's called Psychologists and Torture, Then and Now. And if I page up, I actually have a bio here that I think I skipped earlier. Mr. Polito is an associate professor of political science at Seton Hall University, a former trial attorney, and a contributor to Foreign Policy and Focus. No, I did say that, didn't I? He's the editor of Torture and State Violence in the United States. Lots and lots of that. Okay, so now, when the commercial break so rudely interrupted us, I believe I was about to ask you, it sounds something to me like the American Psychological Association is passing the buck here, and they're saying that, well, they, far be it from them, they would love to do something, but it's up to the states to do anything at all, the state boards and however the law is in each of the states, to take these people's licenses away or fine them or punish them or publicly humiliate them this way or that. And yet it seems to me like they have all kinds of they must have all kinds of power to at least kick them out, make them public disgraces, everybody come together and denounce them, you know, like they're witches or whatever. If some of them can participate in torturing people, then surely the rest of them can come together to blacklist those torturers.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't entirely agree because the same way that the ABA has talked about racial bias in the death penalty or has opposed extraordinary rendition, the APA can play a role by publicly condemning what its members or members of the profession have done. And I think that the recent 2010 letter from the APA does that, and it's a welcome step. The problem is that up until then, the APA was sort of equivocal on the question of exactly what psychologists ought to be able to do. And I think part of the reason is because of the psychologists who were involved in producing the research in the first place. It was kind of like a reluctance to criticize one's own. So there's a limit to what they can do because of the nature of the organization, just like there's a limit to what the ABA can do. Nonetheless, when they do come out with a report, and I'm thinking particularly of the ABA's joint report with a human rights group on presidential signing statements, on another one on extraordinary rendition, these are important statements, and they contribute to the discourse. But there is a difference between an organization that doesn't have enforcement powers and a part of the state that does.
Right. Yeah, I guess I don't really know the ins and outs of, like, say, the American Medical Association or whatever. It just seems like, you know, people all the time say, I'm calling the Better Business Bureau on you. There's all kinds of private comeuppance that can, you know, still be dealt out. And it sounds like, you know, as little as I know about it, it sounds like they would prefer to pass the buck and pretend like this isn't that far outside of the norm or whatever. And maybe it's gone unsaid, really. In much detail, what exactly these psychologists did. They weren't the ones dunking anybody under the water or slamming them against the wall, right? What were they doing?
Well, if you look at the New York Times reporting on this issue, Scott Shane did a number of stories back in 2009, mm-hmm. and Shane reports that, in fact, the Mitchell and Jessen, who ran this consulting business dealing with government interrogations, actually were present at some of the interrogation sites. This is what Shane reports, and others have reported this as well. So it does go beyond simply publishing a paper saying, here's how to get somebody to talk, which raises its own issues, but this is significantly beyond that. The allegations are that the two of the psychologists in particular were actually there and at one point spoke to the subject.
Mm-hmm. And now, you referred earlier to this guy Bitterman, who I guess helped to advance a lot of this stuff back in the first place, and about, you know, how to make someone talk, how to get them to lie or say anything, or how to get them to say something that you can actually rely on. It sure seems like if you look at cases like Binyam Mohammed, who implicated Padilla, or Sheikh Al-Libi, who implicated Saddam Hussein in hijacking techniques and teaching Al-Qaeda about chemical weapons and stuff, that these people were deliberately tortured in order to get them to make up stories. And I wonder whether, you know, in all these years of torture practice, does it seem as though they actually did figure out how to do this right, how to torture you into telling the truth versus how to torture you into telling a lie?
Well, my view is that there isn't a science of torture. I think that, you know, we often believe in this day and age, and particularly in the United States, that technology, scientific progress can solve problems completely. And the question of finding the truth isn't always something that's susceptible to scientific precision. In other words, if a person is being questioned and the person is telling you, I didn't plant the bomb, you can never really know whether they're telling the truth or not. And so this is one of the reasons why I'm categorically opposed to using knows whether the person is telling the truth. I mean, suppose I'm picked up by government security forces and they say, we know you planted a bomb, tell us where it is. And I say, I don't know because I didn't do it. Well, I can say that until I die, literally, and be truthful. And the interrogator says, I know you're not telling the truth. They never know that I'm not telling the truth. I mean, simply through trying to reach it through any kind of persuasive technique. So that's one of the problems, is that you can never be sure that that you have the correct information and you're going to be able to use it to produce a confession or to produce useful information. The other thing is, of course, that interrogators say that typically any kind of interrogation yields small bits of information. And so if interrogation is done, it's not going to yield the entire picture from one person. What it will do is it will yield a clue from one place, which can be combined with a clue from another place to eventually build a bigger picture. And this is true whether we're talking about coercive or non-coercive interrogation. So the problem with using coercive interrogation in this from this view is that you have to torture many people to get information. So it's no longer a question of torturing the one bad guy, so to speak, to save millions of people, but you have to be willing to do that to a larger number of people. And then, of course, the other issue is the practical issue that some interrogation experts have said the best way to obtain information that's useful is through rapport building. In other words, rather than threats, rather than pain, trying to engage in a dialogue with an interrogation subject. So this doesn't involve threats, it doesn't involve pain, it doesn't involve fear, but you can be more confident in what you're getting because you've established this rapport with the subject. One good example to look at to see how this approach is explained by someone who actually does it is the Senate testimony that Ali Soufan gave back in 2009, where he talked about his own experience with counterterrorism and interrogation and how he was opposed to using coercive interrogation of any kind, number one, because it's wrong, and number two, because it doesn't work.
Right. Well, I think, you know, anybody who ever watched a Sam Jackson movie in the 1990s or something knows that that's the way you negotiate with somebody, is, pretend to be their friend as best you can as the cop out in the parking lot on the phone or whatever. That's how you do it. In fact, they did in the 1990s when Bin Laden was still in Sudan. They offered his chief financial guy that, bring your wife to America. We'll do that important surgery that she needs. And he gave the CIA all kinds of stuff, because they gave him the carrot rather than the stick. But that sort of goes back to the line. You don't have to be that kind of, that fancy in copying anything from the North Koreans, Little Red Torture Manual or anything else. It's pretty easy to see that if you just bend some guy's fingers backwards and say, tell us what you know about Saddam Hussein and chemical weapons and hijacking, that at some point he's gonna take the hint that he better come up with something about Saddam Hussein and hijacking. It's not that hard, you know, when Dick Cheney sent you to go and get me someone who will say this, you know, he'll have it in 5 hours.
Right. It's really misguided. And I mean, the absurd, one of the many absurdities of this whole story is that the Albert Biederman back in the 50s came up with a chart that he published in a journal article about how coercion happens. And that chart showed up verbatim, as Scott Shane has reported in the New York Times, showed up verbatim in interrogation protocols post 9/11 at Guantanamo. So Biederman was talking about something entirely different. As Senator Levin put it in a Senate hearing, of course we want information from our enemies. We don't want false information. That doesn't do us any good. And yet nobody seemed to bother to think about that distinction. The other really strange thing about Biederman's chart is that it was used, it has been used over the years by people who are trying to recover someone who joined a cult, people who are trying to work with domestic violence victims. And now it's been sort of reverse engineered, as people who've studied have said, to be used to actually interrogate people.
Yeah. All right, we got to leave it there. Thanks very much for your time on the show today, everybody. That's Robert Polito. His article is at Foreign Policy in Focus and at antiwar.com. It's co-written with his wife, Laura Melendez Polito. And his book is that he edited, Torture and State Violence in the United States. Thanks very much again.